What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello everybody and welcome to a brand new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, I'm recording out in a snow flurry Reykjavik today. And I say that line at the start of every episode, from indie to AAA. And somewhere in the middle there, between indie and AAA, you will find our featured game of this episode. It's going to be an episode that covers the somewhat controversial, critically divisive, Romeo is a Dead Man by Suda51 and Grasshopper Manufacture. A really interesting game that I've been playing across the last few weeks. And it is a really strange one. On some level, it has sort of AAA adjacent production values. On another, it has real, like, silly splattercore aesthetics and some quite surreal and twisted storytelling. So it's quite an interesting game. I've really enjoyed playing it. I was happy to get a code for it, so thanks to the publisher for that, and I'm looking forward to sharing my final thoughts after rolling credits on the game. I think it was about 12, 14 hours, something like that. So that's going to be the featured game of this episode, Romeo is a Dead Man. But as always, let's have a little roundup block at the start, just some things I've been playing, some channel news, some podcast news, some bits and pieces. I'm currently juggling three different games now that I've got Romeo is a Dead Man done and seen credits on that one. The first of them is something that came up during the research for the month ahead indie release video that I do over on my YouTube channel every month. It was a game called Homura Hime. It's a Japanese action game with a sort of stylish character action feel to it. And something that struck me about this game is that when I think about stylish character action games, I think about pretty murky, dark looking games. I think about Metal Gear Revengeance. I think about Astral Chain. I think about Ninja Gaiden and all of those kind of things. And what drew me initially to Homura Hime is that it seems to offer a really tight, flexible combat gameplay, but with a really bright anime aesthetic, and I really wanted to dig into it and find out what it was all about. I have played a couple of hours of it. In fact, I started it up late one night just to check it out, and then found myself looking at my watch an hour and a half later, having beaten the first story boss. There's a lot of tutorial. There's a lot of moves to learn. It's like based around a little hub where you can power up and unlock different people to power up your weapons, a shopkeeper, different ghosts that are going to help you out in different ways, different characters that will hang out there. And then you go into levels, which are actually quite linear combat gauntlets, basically. Each one has a little story, like some kind of curse has fallen on an area. You have to track down the curse. In the first level, you're like picking up some lost toys and wondering what happened to some children. And then it turns out that, you know, there's been some possession, there's a big demon at the bottom of it all. And then you have a climactic boss battle at the end. And for a first boss, I would say this boss had little chill. I kind of got my ass kicked the first time I got to the boss, having not struggled at all. But it was immediately clear to me that this was, it was like my Elden Ring boss instincts kicked in. I was like, this is just a boss that's going to test you. It has five different moves. It has three different phases. With new moves being added in, and I'm just going to have to learn the moves, learn the phases, learn my parry timings, learn my dodge timings, when to get my attacks in, what attacks to use. And so I just kind of locked in, and I think 20 minutes later, half an hour later, took the boss down. So it was the kind of thing where you have to focus up and lock in if you want to get these bosses down. But it was interesting to me that Elden Ring style instinct kicked in as soon as I died the first time fighting that boss. I was like, okay, it's that kind of game. So I've really enjoyed a little dip into Homura Hime. I'll see if the mood keeps me flowing through the game, but I definitely want to put it on your radars out there, especially if you like tight, difficult action games This one has a different kind of aesthetic, and it could be something to look into. I've also been continuing to play Resident Evil Requiem. I'm getting towards the end of the first act, I think. And I've kind of put a pin in it because I got to a part where you kind of come into a very, very dark basement, and it's like a Grace section of the game, where Grace has been really, really disempowered, and it's supposed to disorientate you. It's supposed to put you on the back foot, and it has disorientated me, and it has put me on the back foot. And it's the kind of thing where you're creeping through the dark and there is something there with you. So it's a flip back to that real scary stealth gameplay of the very beginning of the game. I think that this game is really ingeniously cut in two, where you get action gameplay with Leon, where you're just like kicking down doors, beheading zombies, doing one-liners, and you're very, very powerful. You've got a shotgun, you've got like a lot of moves in your disposal, and you really just devastate rooms full of zombies in a really satisfying way. And then you have Grace, which is more like creeping around, disempowered. You still have guns, but you have you're just less powerful guns, less powerful melee attacks. And so we are back to being disempowered again. So the game is a bit of a roller coaster of empowerment and disempowerment. And I'm at a place now where I'm creeping around in the basement. There's some light switches. There's a big monster with me. And I'm like, you know what? This is a bit stressful, a bit scary. I'm just going to put a pin in it and come back to it. So I do fully plan to go and see the back half of Resident Evil Requiem, because I've heard some people talking about it, and I'm quite curious to see what the second big scene of the game is like. But not right now. Something that I have been playing a lot of right now is Esoteric Ebb. I've talked about this game a few times now. It's a Disco Elysium-style fantasy CRPG with halflings, goblins, wizards, dragons, all of that kind of thing. Really, really enjoying it. It's isometric. It has fresh colors. It has dice rolls. It has meaningful choices. It has lots of silly stuff in it. Like, you can make your cleric do all kinds of silly things. And it uses that Disco Elysium style attributes like strength and intelligence, charisma, that will act as voices inside your head. So when you're in certain situations, your strength will encourage you to be like a dumb guy and just like try and dominate people. And then your charisma will try and talk you into being more sly and charming. Your intelligence will relate data to you, data points. And it's quite, actually, the intelligence is quite a cruel attribute. And then you have wisdom, which is actually quite a kind attribute. So you have all of these voices in your head trying to tell you to do different things. You have choices that are just in the dialogue tree for comedic effect, and you can make a real awkward fool out of yourself in a really sort of curb your enthusiasm kind of way quite regularly, like trying to hit on people or trying to overstate your own importance and that kind of thing. But I'm really, really enjoying it. There is a really large play area. I'm starting to kind of, I think I've seen most of the play area now. There's quite a process of kind of exploration and discovery. There's a day-night cycle. Some things are only open at day, some things are only open at night. And it is a mystery game. I've started to uncover some big, important clues in the story, and it's really going places. So, yeah, those are my little games that I've got on rotation at the moment. Homorahime, when I'm in an action mood. Resident Evil Requiem, if I'm in the mood for that, which I haven't been, but we'll get back to. And Esoteric Ebb, which has been taking up most of my time. Sometimes I will sit down to play a little bit of Esoteric Ebb at night, and then, like last night, I think I started at about 10:30 p.m. and I played for a while and I thought, wow, it must be like past midnight. I should get ready for bed, and looked at my watch and it was 2:30 in the morning. So I'd played for like 3 hours straight, 4 hours straight in Esoteric Ebb, and the time just flew by. So when I finish Esoteric Ebb, I will do a featured episode review on the podcast. Same goes for Requiem, if I get to credits. Homorahime, I think, is a bit more of an unknown quantity. I will keep playing and just see if it maintains my interest. So, yeah, nice to have a few games in a rotation. You know, sometimes we're drifting between games, not sure what our next big game is going to be. And I've got, like, a few nice things, you know. I've got a few nice things on the go, so I'm never short of something to play. I do have a few items of podcast housekeeping for you here as well. London Games Festival is coming up, and I'm going to go. It's happening in mid-April. I'm popping over there. I'm going to go on the show floor of New Game Plus and play all of the new games that are there, maybe interview some developers, meet up with friend of the show Kieran Daly, hopefully, and be around in London for all of the festivities there. And as the festival is coming up, I got in touch with Michael French, who is the head of Games London and the head of London Games Festival, And we had a nice conversation the other day, had a good interview with Michael about what people can expect from the festival this year. New Game Plus has changed venues from London Wall to something in a more slick venue in Shepherd's Bush. So I was talking to him about the venue change. I was talking to him about how they pick games, how they source the indie games that are going to be on the show floor. They have announced an initial lineup, and I only knew a couple of them, which I think is a good sign because it's a great way to go and, you know, discover things that you haven't heard of already. So I think if you tune in next week, that will be our episode. It will be a guest episode with Michael French of Games London and London Games Festival. So please do look forward to that. I also wanted to flag up that if people enjoy the indie look ahead stuff where I like sketch out the month ahead, maybe like 15 or 20 interesting games that are coming out. If you enjoy that stuff because it puts games on your radar, I've started cutting those videos up into shorts and then posting them on release day. Because at the start of every month, I'm posting this like download of 20 games to look out for. People forget, people move on, the month moves on. And so I thought, well, if I cut it up into pieces and post them on the day of release, then people will get it in their feed again, and it might act as a really good reminder that something is coming out that day. So if you are interested in that, if you are finding yourself in the YouTube app a lot, if you're on TikTok, those are the two places that I've been posting them. I will put links in the show notes. And if you would like these little vertical videos that are about 1 minute long that you can get in your feed on release day and watch throughout the month, then I am doing that now, and I just wanted to let people know about it because I realized that I've been doing it for a couple of months and never mentioned it. I also wanted to mention that there is a Steam curator page, which I update with friend of the show and fellow podcaster Dovetail of the Pages of Play podcast. If you're on Steam and you like seeing curator recommendations, like if you're looking through 10, 20 new games, scrolling down, looking at the description, wondering whether to get them or not. If it is a game that has been recommended on Gaming in the Wild and you are following my curator page, you will see a little curator recommendation appearing right there in Steam. Then definitely follow the curator page. I mean, I'll put a link to that in the description as well. We're about to update it with a whole bunch of new reviews from the last month or two. So yeah, it's just another little Gaming in the Wild thing that you can follow if you would like to, and that I am remiss about letting people know about. So that's what I've been doing here. And finally, I wanted to mention that I just released another bonus podcast. Patrons of this podcast get bonus episodes on Patreon. There are now, I think, 23 of them. They cover off-topic things like travel, books, music. And for this latest one, I did a little review and sort of diary of the Reykjavik Food and Fun Festival. This is an annual event where chefs from around the world are invited to Reykjavik to cook in a guest restaurant for 1 week only. And we got some really interesting chefs this year. Many, many chefs to choose from. But obviously it's quite pricey. So, you know, picked a couple and went and ate some food from the Basque region. I ate some Japanese Spanish cuisine by a chef who works out in Tenerife at a seaside restaurant there. And a meal by a chef who works in Mexico City, making a fine dining spin on classic Mexican cuisine as well. So if that sounds interesting to you, if you'd like to hear me talking about something other than video games, then do hop into the Patreon. Patreons at the $3 tier or above get all the bonus episodes. And if that sounds good to you, it's patreon.com/gamingintheWild. Special thanks, as always, to my boss tier patrons, Shy Guy, King Champ, Susanna Maria, Nate, Drelish, Rhea Stick Studies, and Noah. They all support me at the $10 tier and get a shout out on every single podcast and video. So you can join the boss tier if you would like to do that as well. And with that, let's get into it and talk about the featured game of this episode. Romeo is a Dead Man.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
And anyone who has played Romeo as a Dead Man will be very familiar with that strange piece of easy listening bar jazz type music. It's played a lot when you're about to fast travel and you're speaking to a strange headless man on a television set. This is the music that you hear during those sequences. It comes up a lot. Quite a soundtrack on this game, actually. It's got breakcore, it's got Japanese rap. There is a lot happening in this game. The easy listening that we're listening to now as well, this strange sort of hold music, I guess. But to start at the start, Romeo is a Dead Man is a game by Grasshopper Manufacture. It is co-written and directed by Suda51, the well-known Japanese auteur game developer, and Ren Yamazaki, who has worked on some Grasshopper Manufacture games as well. It is out now for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series, and PC. I played on PS5 and it ran really well. I think maybe one hard crash in the whole game, and I didn't encounter any serious bugs or crashes or anything like that. I did watch a Digital Foundry video about the game, and they had quite a measured take on it. They talked about the features that are in there and how it's more ambitious than other Grasshopper games to date and other Suda games to date, and they compared it to like where the cutting edge of video game technology and visual fidelity is right now. That was quite interesting, and they had some quite interesting thoughts about the game as well. So I recommend that Digital Foundry video if you're interested in the technical side of things. The game has been very critically divisive, and that's one of the things that gets to the heart of what I want to say about it, actually. So it's a Metacritic 72 right now. And when you see a 72, you often think, I wonder if this game got a lot of, you know, sixes, sevens, and eights, and has come down to be a pretty averagely marked game. You know, in the modern marking scheme of games, we all understand that a seven is okay. You know, it's not blowing your mind. An eight is good, a nine is excellent, a ten is, you know, must play. Anything below like a six, and it must be catastrophic or broken in some way. There are some outlier sites who use marking differently, but I think most people understand review scores this way, where below a six is real bad, seven is okay, and above a seven is good. But that 7 out of 10 Metascore for Remy as a Dead Man doesn't tell the whole story, because this is a game that has had 95 and it has had 40. And neither of those scores are outliers. Like, there's quite a few 40s and there's quite a few 90s. There are enough 40s to fill like an anti-accolades Instagram post that Grasshopper Manufacture put up, saying, thanks for the bad reviews, we'll try and be better. And there were enough 90s to fill an actual accolades graphic, saying, thank you for all the great reviews. So it's one of the more critically divisive games that I've ever come across in the last few years since I've been running this podcast. And I want to run through some of the highs and lows here. Some of the highs include a 90 from Console Creatures, who said, Romeo's a Dead Man is yet another strong action game from Grasshopper that's sure to be divisive. It may not be the best game of the year when all is said and done, but it's hard to imagine anything else feeling quite as unique. So that review tells me that even though the game has rough edges, this reviewer regarded the uniqueness of the game as noteworthy to a greater degree. That was what they valued in this review. The same can be said of Digitally Downloaded, who gave it a 90. And they said, I'm going to read quite a long quote here, but it's interesting. They said, I'd be lying if I said that this game is for everyone. By its nature, the absurdism and surrealism of Romeo's Dead Man is only going to resonate with people who can appreciate that quality about it. The game itself point-blank refuses to be entertaining to play on a passive level. But given that games are becoming more and more generic, best practice-driven, and in general, everything that Romeo is a Dead Man pokes fun at, it's nice to have the occasional game that's willing to put some people off in pursuit of a creative vision. End quote. So here again, this reviewer is weighing the scales of the game and is saying that the flaws are outweighed by the creative vision. Interesting perspective. Some of the lows, Game Cult gave it a 40 and said Suda51 and Grasshopper Manufacture's latest adventure is a hodgepodge fusion of styles and ideas which never coalesce into a coherent experience. And The Guardian, no less, said instead of coming together as a kitschy universe-spanning epic, this sci-fi story is sadly told with all of the mastery of a rambling drunk in Weatherspoons. End quote. Harsh stuff from The Guardian there. And those two reviews tell me that those two reviewers required more cohesion, more narrative cohesion, and more general cohesion, and found this game to be too messy for them. And in their critical opinion, that made it a bad game. So this game has made the critics reveal themselves in a way that not that many games do. Critics that value creativity first and foremost and are willing to entertain some malarkey in service of that love the game. People who want games to adhere to a certain widely accepted level of clarity and cohesion don't like it at all. And I think, you know, I think I can see both of those viewpoints. But, you know, as I say at the start of every podcast, this is a show about games from the creative, artistic side of the tracks. Obviously, the art and the creativity is much more important to me than clarity and cohesion. Although I understand that you can't have all art and no cohesion. I don't think that Romeo does that, honestly. I think if you've ever been sitting in the cinema halfway through a David Lynch movie wondering what is happening before you, then you have been faced by a difficult artwork that is asking you to hang in there with a lack of cohesion and an unconventional approach to story and meaning and creating meaning in games. And I got that feeling playing Romeo as a Dead Man. I mean, obviously it has a very different timbre and style to David Lynch's work, which has this noirish experimental art house vibe going on. This is a game that is much more silly on the face of things, but I do think that it is an apt comparison. It's not a game that is clean. It's not a game that is going to hand over its story, its plotline, in a way that you can smile, sit back and relax with. It's not a game that's ever going to make you feel comfortable about what is happening, really. It's all loose ends. There are hundreds of loose ends. None of them are all tied up neatly. And you're going to have to hang with that if you want to enjoy Romeo as a Dead Man, that's for sure. But I found the freewheeling creativity of Romeo as a Dead Man to be a joy. As someone who has, on this show, bemoaned competent but uninspired games, like Ghost of Yote, for example, which to me is a very dry, cookie-cutter, competent video game that lacks any sense of soul or creativity. You know, so I've put my flag in the sand when it comes to calling games bad for being too competent and not enough inspired. I think Romeo as a Dead Man is less competent, although it's still competently put together. It doesn't crash, you know, you can play it, but it just doesn't play by the same rules. It is loose, it is wild. Ideas are given room to blossom in this game rather than being snipped off as low-hanging fruit during, you know, development optimization. I think that this too is why Death Stranding 2 was actually my game of the year last year, above several much cleaner titles that had, you know, a story that was comprehensible and clearer gameplay aims. But Death Stranding 2 was still my game of the year, and the creativity and the moments it created were a big part of that. I do think that Suda and Hideo Kojima share a little bit of something in their style of creativity, and you could feel that playing Romeo as a Dead Man. So there we go, quite a beefy intro in this review, but it is a big part of the conversation and a big part of how people understand and appreciate this game. But as for what the game actually is, I mean, it was billed as an action game. There was a lot of high-tempo, splattercore action in the first trailer, a lot of breakcore music, machine guns, shotguns, swords, giant greatswords and little rapiers and katana and things like that. And Romeo is just sort of slicing and dicing waves of enemies that came at him with a very colourful, boisterous, high-energy kind of look to it. And that does not tell the whole story of the game. There is action to it, but it also has a lot of story. It has a lot of strangeness. It has a lot of mini-games. It has a lot of time that you spend in the hub talking to people. So, you know, slicing and dicing is half the game, and the rest of it is a bunch of surreal stuff that is all plugged together. But to outline the scenario, Romeo is a cop in a small town. His sister works in the diner. His uncle is a Doc Brown from Back to the Future style inventor. And he is just a cop who's on patrol. He's a pretty straightforward guy. He's infatuated with a mysterious girl called Juliet, who his sister seems very suspicious of, but whom he seems obsessed by. And then one night on a drive through the woods, in his patrol car, he encounters a dead body in the middle of the road. He pulls up to investigate, and while investigating, a demon emerges from the woods and basically mashes poor Romeo, dismembers him brutally and leaves him bleeding and broken with a big part of his head missing, basically. Suddenly, his uncle appears out of nowhere from a time warp as Romeo is bleeding out. He slams this piece of advanced technology into Romeo's eye socket, which regenerates him into a machine guy. He still has Romeo's voice, but his face has been replaced by a strange porcelain helmet. He has like something called a dead ball attached to his helmet, which can morph into different weapons, like the control service weapon. And now that he's been brought back to life, he's no longer a cop. He is a dead man. He is a part robot super cop He was swept up into the space FBI with his uncle to travel through time and figure out what on earth is going on with these demons leaking into the normal world. It's very, very silly. It happens very, very fast. It is not at all concerned with being clean and comprehensible. Things just escalate in a B-movie style, you could say. And suddenly you find yourself flying through space, literally controlling a spaceship. Suddenly you find yourself in a pixel art hub talking to the other space FBI members, some of whom are from different eras of time altogether. You fly through space to find a time portal. All of them lead to a different era, whether that's the 80s, the 70s, the far future, the past, etc. Each one of those turns out to be a level. So Romeo passes through the time window and appears in a setting, like it might be a town hall from 1980 or a shopping mall, etc. These are sites where time criminals are hanging out, and Romeo has to go and hack and slash his way through these various venues, find the time criminal at the end. Sometimes it is a lead that leads to his darling Juliet for some reason. Sometimes you're going to have conversations with Juliet, who takes many forms in this game as well. And so you're off into this nonsensical, unfurling exploration, time traveling, mashed up story with splattercore aesthetics, with pixel art interludes, and just a whole lot of everything happening all of the time. And the story of this game is, it's messy to say the least, definitely. I mean, there is the question of Juliet, who may be something more than she seems. There is the question of the time disaster that has struck Romeo's hometown, whether his uncle's experiments caused it, what is the space FBI, etc. And the tone of the game is really all over the road. It quotes from Japanese mythology, it quotes from history, it quotes from pulp movies. There are lines from philosophers, like the hedonists and stuff like that. It pulls equally from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, David Lynch, Back to the Future, Rick and Morty, Yoko Taro, Kojima, Japanese pop culture. So we've got this mix and match of like 80s pulp sci-fi, classical philosophy, Japanese folklore, and it's just being spoken all of the time. There is a long section where someone that you're talking to just talks about who was the best ever striker in the English Premier League. And so suddenly they're discussing Ruud van Nistelrooy, Eric Cantona, people like this. And I was often to be found just blinking at the screen thinking, why is this in the game? So I can understand why The Guardian viewed this as an unfocused soup of nonsense. But I'd like to offer a bit of counterpoint there and say that wild experimentalism is seldom seen in games and seldom allowed in games of this scale. It's a double-A game. It's a big, expensive, ambitious game. And even if it is messy, imperfect, and sometimes nonsensical, you have to embrace the unhinged nature of the design of this game. I think projects like this should maybe be celebrated for what they are doing and encouraged, given the somewhat dry environment the AAA game development finds itself in a lot of the time. I think that this game punctures what we expect pretty quickly. It throws in everything and the kitchen sink and just tries to see what happens, basically. But it is also, you know, a perfectly legible video game. There are dialogue sequences. The dialogue might be crazy, but, you know, you can click through the text. You can go and upgrade your skills. You can do use the shop. You can make items for healing, etc. And then you go into the combat areas, which are, you know, mostly linear areas where you're going to be exploring. You're going to be unlocking doors using keys. You're going to be engaging in combat. The big part of the game is the combat. So there is, like, you know, a playable game here. It's not like it's completely wild abstract spaghetti. It's a hack and slash adventure game a lot of the time with a lot of action. I quite like the combat. I would say it doesn't quite feel at the level of like cutting edge AAA video game combat. It perhaps feels more like slightly retro take on third person combat, but in a way that made me kind of warm to it. I was like, you know, I understand what this is. I've played these kind of games before. So a lot of hack and slash stuff is present and correct. You've got your light and strong sword attacks. You've got 3-hit combos. You've got 4 different swords to unlock, all of which are upgradable. That you then have ranged attacks. You have a gun that you can pull out. It has endless ammo, but when you run out, you need to reload, which takes, I'm going to say, like 4 or 5 seconds. So you are encouraged to switch up between ranged and melee attacks. You start off with a pretty basic pistol, but you can unlock a shotgun, a machine gun, a grenade launcher that only has one shot and takes a long time to reload. So it depends on your playstyle which one you want to use. All of them are upgradable. All of them have different utility. On some enemies, you're going to be thinking about break a lot, like breaking their stance, especially on mid-bosses and bosses. So you might want that grenade launcher to break them out of an attack pattern and stun them so you can go in on them. The machine gun peppers enemies with bullets, and a lot of enemies have glowing weak spots on them. If you can explode those, they take a lot more damage. And if you miss it with your shot, then you're fighting the full strength basic enemy, having not taken out its weak point. So the machine gun is useful because it peppers the enemy with shots. And even if you're not incredibly accurate, chances are you will pop that weak spot and be able to finish it off with your sword. So you're constantly flickering between your sword and your weapon, your ranged weapon. And then when you're back at base, you're choosing how to spend your resources, which weapon to upgrade, whether you would like more break in your sword or whether you would like more speed of reload in your gun. And there is even more to it than that. There is something called Bloody Sunday, which is like your limit break. And after you've charged up a certain amount of blood, which splatters around quite a lot on screen, you can unleash a powerful special attack. It will finish an entire mob in one hit if they are around you. It will take a decent chunk out of a boss's health bar. And there are different Bloody Sunday attacks for you as well. So you can learn different ones, choose the ones you like, and so forth. And then on top of that, you get deployable zombie helpers. When you can kill enemies, sometimes they drop a seed. And there is this whole other mini game where you're growing zombies in your garden, crossbreeding them to make more powerful zombies. You can unload them in combat on a cooldown. I didn't use them for the first half of the game, but as difficulty picked up a little, I realized that, you know, every 30 seconds I can drop four little zombies that are going to aggro enemies away from me, aggro bosses away from me. And there are tons of types. Some of them are kamikazes that will run in and explode. Some of them will create like a healing spot that you can stand in. Some of them will pepper enemies, various enemies with a ranged weapon and aggro all of the enemies towards it. So they have real utility as well. So, you know, between swords, guns, zombies, Bloody Sunday attacks, all of the different power-ups, all of the different choices you're making, there is a lot to this combat. So even if the feel of it is a little light at times and a little mashy at times, I will say I was playing on the basic difficulty level, the easy level, so it was maybe a little mashy to me. I think if you're playing on normal or difficult, then you might have to be a lot more strategic. But there was so much going on that I found it to be entertaining. It was constantly engaging in a way that I really liked. So I liked the combat in this game quite a lot. As you are working your way around these levels, there is also something called subspace. So every now and then, if you're exploring like a giant 80s mall, you will find a floating TV. If you click on it, you will get a little speech from this strange dude who talks to you. It's a man in a suit. His head is out of shot. He is drinking coffee, and he will give you life advice and tell you stories. And then if you blink through the TV, you will appear in subspace. This is an alternate version of the level that you're in that looks a bit more sort of Tron-like, and it acts as like a time-space back area where you can hop through a TV. You can see all of the other TVs dotted around. It's an open space, and it sort of shows you the shape of the level that you're in. A simple example of how it works is that if you're trying to get into a locked office and there is no way in, but you can see a TV in there through the window, then if you can hop into subspace somewhere else in the level, you might be able to find your way there in subspace and then hop back out into the real world, and you've basically broken into the room without having to use the door. So it's like a parallel level that is used in some sort of light puzzle sort of stuff. Something that I really liked about this is that there weren't enemies in subspace, so you go from combat to this sort of exploring Tron-like puzzle-y stuff. And it broke up the rhythm in a way that I really enjoyed. And then after you've taken down the bosses are pretty cool, actually. You know, they have different patterns, different abilities. They are all custom made. They are sometimes absolute giants. They're sometimes fast moving little devils. They put you to the test. You have to learn their weaknesses. You have to learn their attack patterns, learn how to dodge them, etc. So I quite enjoyed the boss fights. They all had a sense of spectacle. And then between, you go to the pixel art ship. Like inside the space FBI mothership, that you are traveling around to these different places in, there is a top-down pixel art version of this game where you see Pixel Romeo. This is where you plant your zombies. This is where you go and see the nurse who has a strange little text adventure minigame for you. This is where you go and try and power up your weapons by playing a weird little Pac-Man game. You have to collect a currency out in your missions called Flosion that you can then use as coins to pump into this Pac-Man game. And loads of power-ups are dotted throughout this giant Pac-Man maze. So you're flipping between so much different stuff all of the time, so much different art, so much different gameplay. Like the zombie planting game is a whole thing of its own. Like you see Romeo reaching down, holding a wrist and pulling this creature out of the ground. You then have to name them and they get funny little quirks. Like you roll the dice and suddenly you get Marco. He is a zombie who really likes gardening. And then Marco is on your team all of a sudden. There is also a Katsu Curry cooking mini game, which is like an animated sequence where you go in to see your mom in the ship's kitchen. And then if you can cook katsu perfectly and pull it out of the oil at just the right time, then you will get an A-class meal that you can use in-world during combat to give you different abilities that range from increased attack or defense to being invisible for a short time. And towards the end of the game, being invisible can be really helpful if you're lost and you don't want to, you know, fight big baddies constantly. And I will say that, like, the menus in this game as well are sort of Persona level over-designed. The save menu is like booting into a parallel universe 80s computer OS. It has all of the menus in lots of different languages, which I guess is a smart move from the point of localization, but also gives it a certain 80s internationalism flavor. If you die in this game, at least on easy mode, you get to spin a wheel and stop the wheel. It's like a little spinning sort of game show wheel. And sometimes it will give you a full revive, so you can just pop back into the boss with its health bar where it was. If you don't get a revive, then it will give you a buff for your next attempt, like buffed attack or buffed defense. So that's a fun little quality of life thing that's also a strange little aesthetic flourish. There is just so much going on in this game, you know. If you enjoy the action and you enjoy being constantly visually bombarded in a way that is somewhat similar to something like Persona, where you're just like flicking through a lot of weird stuff in a quick rotation, then, I mean, it's just a good game in that sense. It's constantly entertaining and it's never boring. And that's something that I really, really valued about Romeo as a Dead Man. I will say that some of the levels are a little labyrinthine, and I can imagine that if you were getting lost, you might find it humdrum. But at those moments, I was just sort of enjoying the video game. I don't know what to tell you. Like running around these levels, being Romeo, getting engaged in combat, hopping in and out of hyperspace, getting my strange little existential soliloquies from the fast travel man. I just found it to be just really, really engaging most of the time. The game has a lot of references in it too. I mean, there are Shakespeare references. There is this Romeo and Juliet theme. There are references to science fiction books like Sphereland and Flatland, books that I wasn't aware of, but have since gone out and bought. There is references to Shinigami, I think it is, the Japanese Grim Reaper, a creature that measures life in candles and sits at the end of someone's bed as their candle is burning down. There is a reference to Gaia Scutus, a cryptid that hangs out allegedly in US forests. There is a Japanese parable about three men who use their ingenuity to piece together the corpse of a lion and bring it back from the dead. The lion then eats them, and then they are, of course, killed by their own endless curiosity and ingenuity. Sounds like a kind of a nuclear technology parable or something like that. So the game is constantly throwing all of this stuff at you, and I just found it to be intoxicating. And I mean, trying to run through the good and bad of this game feels like a fool's errand, but that is what I do at the end of these reviews. I would say that the game looks great, you know, like the menu screen is like this space fish tank with a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy vibe. All of the menus are amazing. All of the mini games are visually amazing. It has these strange sort of 80s hacker Jeff Minter moments. It has this really nice pixel art stuff that seems like an ode to games past. And then the graphics in the actual action sections are really, really good. I mean, the mall is quite a setting. The town hall that you will return to is an interesting setting too. The subspace sections are diverting and visually interesting as well. I really like the design of Romeo with this strange little orbital helmet that he's wearing and his yellow leather jacket. I didn't even mention that his grandpa morphs into a patch on the back of his jacket like Rick and Morty, and talks to him from the back of his jacket all of the time as well. So you have your little helper with you. I really like the constant wave of different stuff that you're doing, from that Pac-Man style game to the zombie breeding minigame, running around the ship, traveling through space, collecting stuff as you fly. I found the combat to be serviceable and engaging and diverting, which really made the levels work for me. There are these storytelling comic panel sections as well, especially when you meet a boss. You will get a little sort of scene that's told in panels, Gravity Rush style. I really enjoyed that graphic art there as well. And I've talked a lot of smack about the story, and I mean a lot of the reviewers did too, but there is a story there, you know. We do find out what is going on with Juliet. We do find out what is going on with your uncle and what is going on with the time-space, combustion that is occurring. There are various subplots for the different members of your FBI crew. And even if by the end you might just sort of roll your eyes at the ultimate conclusion of everything, if you can not sweat the details and not like and have a bit of faith in the game, then I think you can really enjoy it. You know, I really did enjoy this game. I was never bored. I looked forward to playing it. I think the flip side of the coin is that some of the later levels are quite big and you can find yourself wandering around a little bit, which is less fun than just barreling through these quite linear levels. There is one late game area that is a little annoying. It's like a sort of tower type thing, and if you fall, you have to do it all again, basically. The combat doesn't quite feel like it's on the cutting edge of where things are at, and so, you know, there have been people that say this feels like a 360 game and used that as a real reason to dunk on the game. I personally quite enjoyed that. It felt a little retro whilst looking very contemporary. It is a game that feels a little lost in time somehow. But I think that some people won't gel with the combat for sure. And, you know, the story is a big old mess. There are lots and lots and lots of things thrown at the wall here. And if you don't enjoy how that looks, you know, imagine like taking like a paintball gun and filling it with lots of different colored ammo and then just blasting the wall. It's like you either do or do not like how that looks. It's a narrative version of that. It throws everything at the wall. And I think that some people, if you can't tune into that, let go of the steering wheel of meaning, let it all wash over you, enjoy the silly sci-fi tale that is telling, and, you know, don't try and fill in every gap with logic, because you're not going to find it. And I think whether or not you can enjoy that kind of experience will dictate whether or not you enjoy this game. And I think that's a nice rounding off point. I think that nothing that Romeo is a Dead Man does is perfect, but I think that everything that Romeo is a Dead Man does is interesting. And for me, that makes it worth playing alone. This is an incredibly interesting video game. It's not something that I'm going to forget playing. That is Romeo is a Dead Man. And there we have it. That is our episode. That was Romeo's a Dead Man. I hope you enjoyed the review. I felt like this game flummoxed me a little bit. I feel like my reviews are usually a lot more crisp than that. It is a confusing game that throws a lot at the wall, and so trying to explain it is like, you know, rifling through a plate of spaghetti, looking for, you know, a shape. But I hope that you enjoyed hearing me at least wrestle with the game and try to get to the bottom of it. I really did enjoy it. I think it's a really fun game. Maybe if you're in doubt, then just wait for it to be on sale. Pick it up for 20 quid or something. It's worth playing, man. I also enjoyed talking about Homurahime, the anime character action game. My battle with plucking up the nerve to play Resident Evil Requiem, and the constantly unfolding joy that is Esoteric Ebb. I'm looking forward to getting to the bottom of Esoteric Ebb. I think that's going to be the next game that I finish, and probably the next game that I will review on this channel. But before that even, we have the London Games Festival interview coming next week. I'm trying to get back onto a more regular cadence with podcasts. As you may have noticed, I think this is the third in 3 weeks, and we have, you know, two more queued up notionally. So I'm trying to get back onto a weekly schedule. But if you ever find that there is not a Gaming in the Wild coming out in the week or for your weekend, then check out the YouTube channel for sure. I'm always uploading something there. There are long form videos. There are the month ahead videos. There are the shorts telling people when games come out. And there are also monthly bonus episodes right now. You know, I usually do three or four a year. This year, my New Year's resolution is to do one per month. This month's episode has just gone up. It is about that food festival. So hop into Patreon at $3 or above, and you will get access to all 24 bonus episodes and another, you know, 9 or 10 throughout the course of this year. And with that, I will stop talking now. I will go and make my girlfriend dinner. She is waiting for me to finish this podcast and go and cook. I hope you enjoyed the show. And until next time, take care of yourselves and each other. And bye-bye for now.